From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the April 2017 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Off Duty. A select group of Bletchley Park veterans have returned today to tell the story of how spirits were kept high in low times. This delightful bunch are having lunch at the moment, but they're here for an intimate question and answer session, and they'll be sharing details of how they spent their precious time off duty. We'll bring you more from these five shortly. Also coming up in this month's episode, we'll hear memories from one of the hundreds of veterans who've taken part in Bletchley Park's oral history project about how she spent her precious off-duty time. Barbara Allen, née Grig, remembers being in Trafalgar Square watching doodlebugs falling and being told off by a passing officer for not taking cover. This was during one of many trips to London on days off from operating bomb machines at Eastcote, where she and her friends used to enjoy cheap theatre tickets and dinners for a shilling in the crypt at St Martin's in the Field. More from Barbara in a little while. But first, Museums at Night makes a welcome return next month, this time exploring the night shift. As darkness falls, experience the hush of the huts, just as the wartime workers would have done. The last Museums at Night fell close to Halloween, and podcast producer Mark Cotton went along to see just how spooky the park can be.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, if you're looking out this way, you can see lots of bright lights. The bright lights of peacetime. We're not under threat at the moment. If you look behind you, you've got the gloom and the darkness of World War II. In World War II, there was the blackout. All the lights had to be turned out at night, or if lights were on, they had to be covered over with blackout curtains. Any of you youngsters tell me why we had to turn all the lights off in the war?
So the German planes couldn't see?
That's right, so the German bombers couldn't see. If there were lots of lights showing, they would realise that it was a town or a city, and they would probably drop their bombs on that area. So we had to black out. Right, we'll move up this way, ladies and gentlemen, into the wartime gloom. Here you've got a sentry post, and when you would have arrived, if you'd been recruited to come to Bletchley Park, you would have come up this avenue. There would have been none of these houses, certainly not cars doing manoeuvres in the middle of the road. This was a lonely country lane you would have walked up from Bletchley Station. Now, war was declared, of course, in September 1939. The Codebreakers returned from London. They were quickly followed by all those people who'd gone through those courses during the year 1938 to 1939. So the number of people working here at Bletchley Park grew very rapidly within weeks of war being declared. Imagine yourselves, ladies and gentlemen, to be teenage, maybe in uniform. You've been given orders to report to Bletchley Park. You don't know what Bletchley Park is, you don't know where it is, you've just been told to go to a station in the middle of the... People here at Bletchley Park during the war were obviously worried about bombing. They were out here in the countryside, but they knew about the bombing in London and Coventry and places like that, and it was clearly a realistic danger. If you look to your right through the trees there, you'll see what is now the children's playground area. And it's on a raised area. Underneath the playground is the air raid shelter. That's where people would go if there was a danger of a bombing raid. Bletchley Park was bombed on one occasion, 21st of November 1940. And one of the bombs that fell on Bletchley Park and exploded landed right here where we're standing, this little clearing. It exploded in this soft ground. Fortunately, the ground here is very soft. So although it did explode, it didn't do very much damage to the mansion and the huts. But it certainly shook up the staff when it went off. Other bombs fell further over. Another one fell near Hut 10 at the other side of the park. In fact, that one didn't explode. But other bombs fell on the rectory and the school and did a lot of damage. Thankfully, nobody was killed. It was actually thought to be an accidental bombing. It was a German aircraft, but he didn't know what he was bombing. It's believed that he'd been on a raid to somewhere in the Midlands, couldn't find his target, was heading back to Germany, and thought, I better get rid of the bombs before I go back.
so he just let go the bomb load over Bletchley, possibly aiming at the railway line, which he missed. That was the only time that Bletchley was actually bombed.
That's another bomb.
The sound effect. You like the sound effect? Good. Okay, right, we'll move on again. We owe them a huge debt of thanks. Their achievements were incalculable. General Eisenhower, later to become President Eisenhower, said that the efforts of the codebreakers here at Bletchley Park shortened World War II by 2 years, saving hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of lives. Hopefully this tour has given you an idea of what life was like during World War II. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Yeah.
Easter is upon us, and it's a vintage bank holiday at Bletchley Park. You can explore the grounds in search of secret treats in our Easter egg hunt and have a go at code-breaking-inspired activities in the vintage marquee. Outdoor games will also be laid on for the whole family. There are lots more vintage, code-breaking and World War II-themed events at Bletchley Park throughout the summer. Keep an eye on the website for details. Bletchley Park's brand new exhibition, Off Duty, High Spirits in Low Times, is now open. It explores what happened outside of the gruelling shifts the thousands of workers did day and night. Wartime work at the Government Code and Cipher School was stressful and tiring, but the authorities understood it was important to keep staff happy and healthy. I'm in great company at Bletchley Park today with Betty Webb, Betty Laurie, Arthur Maddox, Joan Joslin and Liz Fulton. They're all here to tell an intimate audience about their memories of what they did when they weren't cracking enemy codes.
So firstly, we have Arthur Maddox. Arthur was in the army and he came to Bletchley Park in August 1944 and was here for about a year. He worked in Block F, which was the testery, working on wheel settings on fish. Next to Arthur, you have Betty Webb. Betty was with the ATS. She came to Bletchley Park in October 1941 and was actually here till 1945. Firstly, working in the mansion until 1943 in the military section, German police index signals. And then she moved to Block F in 1943, and then she was with Japanese military subsection, paraphrasing deciphered Japanese signals. She then moved to Washington. That was in June, and she was out there until September 1945 with the British Joint Services Mission, again on Japanese signals. Then next to Betty Webb, we have Betty Laurie. Betty came here in January 1944 and was in here till the middle of 45. She then moved to Berkeley Street in London and was there until early 1947. Betty worked in Hut 16 in something which was called CMY, Cover Management Y, and she ended up as a control supervisor there. Next to her we have Joan Joslin. Joan arrived in 1942 and was here till 1945. She worked in Block C and was a Hollerith operator decoder. Joan, just as an extra, actually met her husband here. So we'll, I'm sure, have some stories about that once we get further in. This is Elizabeth Fulton, and she was a Wren, and she came to Bletchley Park in 1944, was here again for about a year, and she worked in the naval section on Japanese, and again, she was in Block C. So I think I'm going to start with Arthur, if you don't mind. You said to us earlier that you saw quite a few of the plays and that sort of thing here.
Plays were extremely well done. By the time I got here in 1944, the drama group was drawing on this quite extraordinary variety of talent, not only acting but producing and everything else. And as you can see, if you go into the exhibition, there's a whole lot of programmes there indicating the really excellent plays that were put on. And I was simply a spectator. I had no part in producing these plays.
And also, there was a Home Guard here at Bletchley Park.
There was, but by the time I got here, there was no threat of an invasion. I was already in the army. I'd already had two or three years of military training. And I had at one point been in the Home Guard when I was doing this military training as a student at Oxford. But I don't recall that during my last year, during 44 to 45, I don't recall that at any point I was called upon to do anything in the way of military training. My entire obligation was to work for 8-hour shifts, 6 days a week, and outside those 48 hours, I was completely free to do whatever I liked.
Betty, when you were here, you were billeted out with a family rather than being in a hostel and things like that sort of thing. What was that like?
I was billeted in Loudoun eventually until the camp was built, the back here built for the Army and the Air Force. And I had plenty of opportunity to get around because I had a bicycle, one of the ones that's in the hut down there now, I think. Anyway, bombings permitting, I used to get out to London when I could. If London was out of bounds, as it often was, I would go to Oxford or Cambridge or just cycle round the countryside. And we had opportunities to join in events in the villages round about. I was also fortunate in having a friend from college days who ended up in Woburn Abbey. And so occasionally I would spend the weekend with her. But I have to say that that was a rather cold establishment and was not quite as comfortable as the billet I was in.
And is it correct you are still in contact with the family that you were billeted with?
Yes, indeed. They live in Loudoun. And, well, now there's only one of them left, the youngest son, who went on to serve in the tank regiment. And I spoke with him the other day. He has just been given one of the Légion d'honneur medals, which the French have given to all our men and women who served in France. And very sadly, he told me about it, and he said, but unfortunately, I'm completely blind now, but I know I've got it. But isn't it sad?
Oh, that's sad, but lovely also that he's finally been awarded the same as you were a few years ago, and obviously long overdue. Right, Betty. Another Betty.
Another Betty.
Another Betty.
it ages us.
Right, I'm going to ask you about one specific event. You may know, some of you, or may not, that the Duchess of Cambridge had an aunt, was it a grandmother and an aunt, wasn't it? Yeah, was here, and that also worked here, and Betty actually worked with them. They were the Glassborough twins, and when you think of where the Duchess of Cambridge now is in her position, if you hear the story about her relatives and what happened on V-Day plus two.
Well, I met the Duchess of Cambridge and her grandmother and her grandmother's twin sister, who worked on my watch in Hut 16. They came from Leeds, and I came from York, so we had a sort of Yorkshire affiliation from the word go. And we got on very well together. And I was on night duty when the war was ended, which was a very, very exciting night because all the information was being chivvied along from radio to radio all around the world. But the trouble was, when I got back to my billet, the general public didn't know about this, so I had to keep very quiet and not say a single word and creep into my bed to go and have my daytime sleep, which I never find very easy. But in the evening on VE plus two, because my night duty didn't start till midnight, so I went up with the twins and we went into Green Park, where we met a chap whom I had got to know through my work and who had often taken me out to lunch and shown me some of the sights of London, which was very nice. And he brought along a bottle of gin and a bottle of baby's orange juice. And as he was a single man, where the baby's orange juice came from, I shall never know. But anyway, we sat in Green Park imbibing all this. And of course, by the time it came to catch our bus, and I was going back on to night duty, we were absolutely pickled. And somehow, he put us onto the bus, so that was all right. And somehow we managed to get off at Euston Station, which was a miracle. And I remember losing my handbag under the seat at about three rows in front of me. And I must have been able to retrieve it somehow, but I couldn't have cared less. It didn't worry me at all. Anyway, I thought, well, this is wonderful. And we got onto the train, and I pushed the twins off at their station before Bletchley, and I went on to night duty. I don't know what happened to them, whether they managed to get from the station to their billets or not. I hope so. Well, anyway, I saw them after that, and they were fine.
Right, let's go on to Joan now. You met your husband here.
I did.
When you arrived on Christmas Eve, I believe it was.
That's right.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about that story first?
Yes, I arrived with another young lady. The pair of us walked into Block C on Christmas Eve, 1941. And my husband had been at Bletchley then for a year, and he was with a colleague standing about 10 yards, I suppose, away from us two, and we were quivering with fright because we didn't know what to expect, plus the fact it was Christmas Eve and we weren't too happy arriving at Bletchley, you know, at that time of the year. Anyway, I heard my husband say to his colleague, "I'll have the blonde, you can have the dark one." As it happened, he eventually got the other one and I married him. And I didn't lose him until last year, which was very sad. But he was stationed with me in Block C for 5 years and he didn't know what I was doing. He had no idea, and yet we were in close proximity of each other for 5 years. It was a very eventful arrival.
Liz, you were at Woburn Abbey for your billet while you were with the Wrens. What was it like living there?
I started off at Wavendon House in the stables, which were 26 of us on night duty, all coming in different hours of the night. And that was a bit much, really. But I moved on quite quickly to Woburn Abbey. We lived in the top. I remember quite a small room at the top of the abbey, and I made three other very good friends there, all of which have now gone, sadly. But while actually staying at the abbey, we had a lovely time because we were well fed and it was a beautiful place, really, although we didn't have much of a bedroom. A cabin, it was called. But during the day, I found a farmer who had two horses, and he allowed me and my friend to ride his horses, and we rode his horses all over Woburn Abbey. And so that was very good in our off time during the day. And I really had a very happy time at Woburn Abbey. And the grounds are wonderful. We were conscious that the buses did hit the deer sometime at night, which the old Duke wasn't keen on. He was very tetchy about it, which one can understand, I suppose. The drivers did try to be careful, and the deers were all over the place. Anyway, we had great fun riding in those lovely grounds.
Joan, what happened on VE night?
Well, we were on duty in Block C, deciphering a very important message that had come in. So we were given 48 hours leave, and we just couldn't wait to get home for 48 hours. So we got the last train from Bletchley and arrived on Euston Station. I suppose it must have been about 10:30. And it was milling with all sorts of people, all in uniform or civilian, Americans, Canadians, all different nationalities. And there were hundreds and thousands of people just milling together. And I wanted to shout, "The war's over." And I couldn't. And my husband and I waited for the first train or tube to start at 5 o'clock. And we got home. I walked in on my mother and woke her up and got a dressing down because I'd been out all night. And I couldn't tell her. And she never knew, ever. And she died not knowing. Both sets of parents had no idea. Even when we were allowed to talk about it, we didn't.
No, we knew how to shut up, didn't we?
We didn't, did we? No.
That's the thing that's quite sad, isn't it, for a lot of you. You've had all this time and you couldn't tell them what you were doing. I think you had another story, Joan, actually, just with your mother-in-law-to-be and what she actually thought you were doing here.
Well, when my husband first took me home, my mother-in-law said to him, "And where does your young lady work?" And he couldn't think. It was such a direct question. He had to think quickly and he said, oh, she works the machine. And he didn't say another word. Well, 40 years later, on our 40th wedding anniversary, she took me into the kitchen and she said, "I'll tell you now, I'm so glad you made my son happy, but I have to tell you, I did not want him to marry a factory girl." And I still didn't tell her.
And she still didn't tell her. She still kept it secret. That's just amazing, isn't it? Betty Webb, Americans and socialising with the Americans. Have you got any nice stories to tell us?
Yes, it isn't quite as exciting as you might think. And I can't remember exactly when it was, but I believe I'm right in saying that about 600 Americans arrived here towards the end of the war. And they were a very nice bunch of folks. And they came, obviously, with a lot of goodies, which we'd been deprived of throughout the war. I mean, the food and the drink was unbelievable. And I think there were probably stockings as well, not tights, stockings. And they put on all sorts of events for us, mainly food and drink and dancing and so on in Wilmore Avenue, whatever it is. And we did have a very good time, and they contributed a great deal to the intelligence side of it. And interestingly, I was quite friendly with one of them who used to take me to dances and so on. And I kept in touch with him and his wife until 2009, when I went over to America for another reason and met up with them in Washington. And that's the last I saw of them. But I think it's rather interesting that a friendship started that long ago could last until 2009. You know, so often we lose track of people we met during the war, but in this case, we corresponded regularly and, as I say, met up in 2009.
Arthur, you mentioned plays and that sort of thing. Where were they put on? Were they here?
They were in the Assembly Hall. I think one should also mention dances. We had a tremendous lot of dances in the Assembly Hall, in the Army.
Oh, lovely.
Place and all over the place. Everybody was dancing at that time. And I particularly remember going to a dance. I think it was at Wavendon. It was certainly one of the Wrens hostels. I, of course, was wearing khaki, and here were all these hundreds of beautiful girls in their navy blue skirts and white blouses, and very few males for them to dance with. They were mostly dancing with each other. And it was absolutely obvious that I couldn't dance with the same girl twice. It was also obvious that you couldn't talk about what went on in Bletchley Park. So by the time, if you were lucky, you'd found some common point of interest with the partner, by that time the dance would end. And all this was supervised by some eagle-eyed Wren officers who were looking after the virtue of all these poor little girls. So the experience was not naturally unpleasant. I decided not to give another such invitation given by the Wrens, but rather to go to the other dances in the Assembly Hall or in the Army camp.
Betty Laurie, where were you billeted?
I started off in Bedford. I was in a council house in Bedford, and I come from Yorkshire. And people in Yorkshire had always been told, people down south who had baths in council houses always kept their coal in it. So I was somewhat relieved to find that in my council house, it was used as a bath. And but you only had a bath once a week, and you had to pay for that. And not only that, you were only allowed, anyway, 3 inches of water, so you could hardly get clean, really. And anyway, it was quite a nice council house, but I was only there for about a month because I was then put on to night duty from time to time, so I was on a rota, and you couldn't really do that from Bedford. So then I was very fortunate and got into the Grange at Aspley Guys, which was a lovely house, and I had a downstairs bedroom with my own entrance, and it was really very luxurious indeed, a very nice family, whom I kept in touch with for quite a long time. I don't know, I had 2 children, I lost touch with them, but I kept in touch with the parents, and I was extremely fortunate to have such a very comfortable billet.
Joan, you also were billeted out with a family. How was your experience with that?
Oh, I was very happy. They had to take me because if you had a spare room, you couldn't refuse to take somebody, even if you had no furniture. My landlord and landlady, they didn't have a stick of furniture. So the government provided carpet, bed, desk, everything that I would need in the bedroom, which was a nice room. So I was very, very fortunate. They were allowed to keep those articles of furniture after the war, which they were very pleased about. They made me very happy. They were very kind. He was a baker, and so I didn't want for cakes or bread or anything like that, which was lovely, really. You know, he was a very, very nice man. They were a lovely family. They couldn't have done more for me. I've kept in touch with them to this day. There's only one of them remaining, actually, but I still keep in touch. I was very grateful to them. He used to play the trumpet, and I used to accompany him on the piano. He used to play a tune called The Juggler, and I always remember it. When I hear the tune, it brings it back, you know? They were a lovely family. Couldn't have been happier.
You also had a lot of dealings with the WVS club in Wolverton?
Yes, Ken and I belonged to the WVS club. Ken was billeted in Wolverton, which was about 2 miles from where I was billeted. I was in New Bradwell. The lady that ran the WVS, her name was Mrs. Tinkler, and she was lovely. She was motherly, and she really made a fuss of Ken. He couldn't do anything wrong. She used to bake for him, do all sorts of things. She couldn't have been nicer to him. And he used to go up to the club to play table tennis. And I used to go up to play the piano. So between the pair of us, we had some lovely evenings up there. You know, we relied on that because apart from dancing, which we did most of the time, or the cinema, there was nothing else. But that club was lovely. Thoroughly enjoyed it. And as I say, I've never forgotten Mrs. Tinkler.
Just generally to all of you, what was it like being at Bletchley Park? Was it a time that you've enjoyed? Did you have many problems with illness and things like that? Because, I mean, we do hear sometimes a lot of people were unwell and that sort of thing.
I got mumps. I felt a bit full in the neck one day, and I went to the doctor and he said, nothing wrong with you, you're fat anyway. Anyway, the following day, there wasn't any doubt about it, so I was... So all right, you laugh. I was put in an ambulance and driven to Northampton De La Vera Camp Hospital. It happened to be at the time when the manoeuvres were going on prior to D-Day. So all the way from here to Northampton, if you can imagine the geography, I was having to... put up with aeroplanes zooming over hedges with about that much to spare, you know, that sort of thing. And then suddenly I felt a bit ill, and I asked the ambulance driver to stop, which she did, and I got out and found myself confronted by 2 guards officers who were pretending to be German invaders. You may well laugh, I was petrified. So anyway, I was very ill in front of them. They didn't seem to put them off. And they said, could they have a lift? And I said, well, if you don't mind catching mumps, of course you can. So these two guards officers, I say masquerading as Germans, got into the ambulance with me and off we went to Northampton Hospital, where I languished for a week, lost a stone in weight, so the doctor couldn't argue about my... I survived it, but by gosh, I was ill. And I understood fairly recently that there was actually an epidemic at that time. Yeah, so, you know, it wasn't all beer and Skittles. It was quite funny.
It seemed to me that during the one winter I spent in Bletchley, it was a succession of colds. I suppose because we worked, we kept the staff going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we didn't bother to open the windows because they had to preserve the heat. And I suppose every time anybody sneezed or coughed, the whole place was full of these wretched germs. So it was a series of cold after cold, I seem to remember. And at one time, my cold got slightly worse than usual. And they moved me from the army camp to a special little sort of army nursing home in Penny Stratford. I think the idea was to keep us out of hospital, therefore away from the possibility of talking to people that didn't know anything about Bletchley. So when I was there, I had to send a telegram to the nurse in London that I was courting at the time, and because it was impossible to telephone her. And I simply sent this telegram saying that I couldn't meet her on the agreed date because I was in bed with flu. And it was the custom in this hospital for the matron to open all telegrams because at that time they were only too likely to bring rather bad news. And unfortunately, the post office that transmitted this telegram made a slight corruption. Instead of saying flu, they said flow. The matron thought that her nurses should devote themselves totally to nursing and not mess about with the young men. So she probably hoped that it was indeed flow and not flu. The lady who eventually became my wife.
Bloxley was bitterly cold, wasn't nice, and it wasn't a very nice place to work in. So if you got a cold, you really got a bad cold. And I can remember that directly I got a cold, Ron, who was my landlord, used to say, right, up to bed. And he'd send me off to bed and then he'd bring hot milk with whiskey in. I was quite lucky, really.
No, I think it's just the thought of being all of you shut in some of those rooms. Yeah, we know when...
Nowhere, freezing cold.
That's it, and smoky and things like that. And we know from when we've been restoring the huts, Hut 3 and Hut 6, finding, because they had been so cold, just paper stuffed into cracks to try and make. But of course then, yes, you're getting some heat inside, but you're also keeping all the germs inside. So I think a lot of people did suffer. And the fact the hours they worked as well, because they were doing such long hours, a lot of people did end up being ill and that sort of thing. Right. Anyone else that's got any little story that they'd like to tell us about before we have our little break?
Yes, I did have an Air Force chap who... I used to go from my bicycle once or twice. I could see there was somebody following me on a bicycle. So I thought, well, I'm going to give him the slip. So I used to cycle terribly, terribly fast and go around the corner and do all sorts of things. And I usually managed to give him a slip, but once I didn't. And he caught up with me. And actually, then we used to go cycling together quite a bit. And we used to go into the woods. And the woods were absolutely fascinating because they had these enormous big anthills which were all made of pine needles. And I found those extremely interesting because they were such an extraordinary shape. Many, many years later, my brother-in-law, who was a golf architect and used to do golf courses, he made the golf courses woven. And I said, what did you do with all the anthills? And he said, oh, I never saw them. He never went into those woods. I did it all from the contours of the map and from a helicopter. I have no idea what happened to them. But one of these Americans gave me the little sort of, they had little things on their hats, which was a metal thing. And he gave me one. And in those days, a lot of English girls were getting married to Americans. And he said, I'd like to give you this, but please, it is not an engagement ring. And I said, I would not accept it if it were.
Some of you are far too young, perhaps, to understand this, but, well, we had what was known as gas mask drill every Wednesday morning, and we were obliged to actually wear the gas masks, which were not the civilian ones, they were the heavy army ones, which really were very devil to get on and off. For a bit of entertainment on these Wednesday mornings, one of my colleagues, Tubby Roots, you may remember him, he used to sing very loudly with his gas mask on, in the mood. And you have never heard such a row in all your life. All the rubber bits would sort of do this. But anyway, that was our week's entertainment.
Right, just another question. Actually seeing your family, obviously most of you, I presume, this was probably the first time you'd been away. How often did you get back?
Very seldom. We weren't entitled to leave. We were just given leave if circumstances were that we could be spared or something like that. There was never any rule about leave. So it was a 24-hour thing.
I lived at the time, or rather my parents lived, near Ludlow. I was faced with my 21st birthday, Bletchley. Anyway, I managed to get leave. But the irony was, because it was Ludlow, those of you who perhaps know the geography, it meant getting a train up to Crewe, I think, and then to Shrewsbury, and then down to Ludlow. So you can imagine, it took most of my birthday getting there and back. But the bonus was, my parents living in the country had access to decent butter and that sort of thing, and I actually had a 21st birthday sandwich cake.
My 21st birthday, we had arranged that we would have dinner at 7, and we'd only have half an hour, and then we'd all go down to the pub, which is at the bottom of the road here. And so several of us, army officers, naval, etc., we all got together, and I got my dinner, which was a sardine sandwich. And I hurriedly ate it. And then we went down to the pub, and we played a game called Cardinal Puff Puff. Have you ever heard of it?
Yes, yes, I have.
Where you have a large glass of Pimm's to begin with, and you take a sip, stand up, turn round, sit down, and you do all take a turn until you finish the Pimm's. By the end of that, I just could not stand up. And it was my 21st birthday. So my friend who was with us said, how am I going to get you back to the park in this? She was furious. She was disgusted with me. It's the one and only time in my life that I've been drunk. Oh. And that's the truth. Anyway, we got up to the gates, and of course we had red caps on duty with fixed bayonets. And so I had to get past them to get back into the office. And I just could not stand up. So they, a pair of them helped me through. And I eventually, I would have been in serious trouble had I been caught, really. But that was the one and only time that I was truly naughty. But I had to sit through the rest of the night watching wheels on a machine going round or turning, and I was like this. And I was totally out of it, totally. All I can remember is this friend of mine filling paper baskets with me just being ill. So it wasn't a very pleasant experience. And it was the one and only time, honestly, that I've ever been drunk.
So you're not going to forget your 21st birthday then, Jo?
No.
Arthur, what about you? Did you get home very often, or were you...?
Well, for me it was really no problem, because I'd left home 4 years earlier when I went to Oxford, and then I had 2 years in the army. My family were in Manchester, so it was much easier to get to Manchester than it was to get to Ludlow on the main line from Bletchley, no problem at all. And in the army we had a week's leave every 3 months, I think it was. So every 3 months I get on the train and go to Manchester. All the other time, I'd be rather more occupied in London.
Yes, obviously, with your girlfriend at the time. What about you, Betty?
Not very often, but when we had more than 24-hour leave, I would take the train and go up to Yorkshire, yes. But it was a rather rushed affair always.
Can I just ask everyone to thank Sue, our compere, and of course... and can you all give a round of applause to our wonderful 5 veterans for their service?
Think of this, you're away from home for the first time. You're doing a job that you know is crucial to the war effort. Don't forget, everyone has their part to play in this national endeavour to save the country from being invaded by the Nazis. Think about the pressure you would feel, and then think about how much you'd treasure your downtime. What would you do? Burn off steam by partying in London with your new friends? Or go home and see your family every chance you get? Or immerse yourself in what must have been somewhat like campus life and join the clubs and societies laid on? Of course, most of the workers at Bletchley Park did a bit of all of these things. And when they share their memories with the Oral History Project, it all helps form the rich tapestry of what happened here. Barbara Allen, née Grigg, takes us back 75 years.
I'm Peter Clark from Bletchley Park Trust, and I'm talking to Mrs. Barbara Allen. So, if we can very briefly just have a sort of quick overview of where you served.
Well, I served at Eastcote. Originally, when I joined, I was sent to Mill Hill. I was there, I think, for a very short time. I think there were a few of us at the station who went together. And as we were walking into the grounds of Mill Hill, there were a lot of women in navy blue overalls. And I looked around and I said, goodness, they've got a lot of people working here, haven't they, looking after the place. Well, of course, the following week, we were the ones who were in the uniforms looking after the place. And I was there for a very short time. And they were obviously sorting us out into the jobs they wanted us to do. And I was brought out with a little group. And they said, we want you to be interviewed for a particular job which you might be able to do. I remember going into a room and there was a Wren officer sitting at a desk. She just asked me a bit about myself. Then she said, there's a very important job and we're selecting some people for it today. You have been selected as a possibility for it. She said, I can't tell you anything about it. There's no money in it. There's no promotion. That's all I can tell you. And you either say yes or no. So I thought, well, I'll die of curiosity if I say no. So I said yes. And as I remember it, we were taken in a 3-ton lorry and we all sat in the back, I think probably about 12 of us. And we were taken to Eastcote, of course. That was where we did our training, but my memory of the training isn't very good. I can't remember how long it was. I was 18 then.
18.
I just left school, grammar school here in Oswestry Street. And at the school at that time, the headmistress, it was just either teaching or nursing was what we did. I decided I wasn't cut out to be Florence Nightingale, so I decided I was going to go teacher training. I spent, I think, one term in a school just to see what was going on. This was a primary school, and I decided that it wasn't for me. I didn't want to do it. So I then was thinking, what am I going to do? And I'm afraid it wasn't anything to do with king and country. I just thought, well, I think my father was in the army, you see, abroad. And I thought, oh, well, I'll join one of the services. Volunteered for the Wrens.
Mm. Why did you choose the Wrens?
I think I liked the uniform. But of course, the other two, the ATS and the WAFs, they were conscripted, but the Wrens were volunteers.
Mill Hill was all scrubbing and cleaning
that
and saluting and putting the flag up.
Yes, yeah. Yes. We did a little bit of marching up and down and taught how to turn and that sort of thing. Mm.
Did you complete any tests or questionnaires to do with your ability? No.
That's all that I had that day. I don't know how she was deciding. Obviously, this person who interviewed me, which was very brief and the only one I had, she must have decided on very little, really. Mm.
So you were perhaps at Mill Hill about 3 or 4 weeks?
Yes,
perhaps,
something like that. Yes.
And then you were put on this truck and you were taken to East Cove. Did they tell you where you were going?
No, not really. No, they didn't tell us anything. We were told that it was very important work, but we weren't told that it was anything to do with codes and ciphers or anything like that, or anything to do with machinery. We weren't told anything.
Were you told what section name you were going into?
We probably were, but I can't remember.
Right, I think, according to your
sheet, it was on that, yeah.
Pembroke 3.
That's right.
Right, yes. Or P3, but you don't remember them making an issue of that?
No, not at all.
So you went to Eastcote. You had some sort of training there,
yes,
as you recall.
Yes. Well, we must have been trained on the bombs.
Mm-hmm. From what I gather, it's a few weeks, I think, at most.
It wasn't very long.
No, not
very long at all.
No. Were you with people you knew at that point, the 12? Anyone you'd volunteered
nobody,
with?
Nobody. The only people I knew were the ones I came from Paddington, I expect it was, to get to Mill Hill. But I didn't know anybody before I went there, no.
After your training, can you recall when you first started doing the real job?
Well, as I was saying, I think it would have been a few weeks.
Were you in a room or a bay?
The block where the work was done was separate from our living block, and we walked from one to the other, so it was only 100 yards, a bit more maybe. It had a very, very long corridor, and there were bays off the corridor, and they were all named after admirals or famous sailors. And there was sort of a little section where the petty officer had a room, and then the door opened into a room where there were little individual bays of about 6 bunk beds, and I was in the bunk bed nearest to the door. The building where we worked there were police on the gates, and it was, I think it had, as far as I can remember, it had some sort of a wire fence around it. We had identity cards, and we had to show those when we went in and when we came out. I assume they were police, they were in uniforms. Mm-hmm. So it was a secure place in that sense.
Yes. The bays where you worked, can you remember how many bomb machines there would be in a bay?
Well, each bomb, I think, was separated. I would think possibly about 6, but I can't really terribly remember that.
How many wrens, how many others would you work with on a particular machine?
Well, there were two of us working on the bomb. We both worked doing the settings from the menu, given a menu, as you must know, and putting the drums on the front. And we had to, as you know, again, I will know, tease them so that no little wire was touching another little wire. It was quite, scary because it was dinned into us, so we mustn't get it wrong. And then the plugs at the back. One of us did the plugs at the back and one of us did the drums at the front.
Did you alternate that or did you always tend to?
No, I think we probably alternated it. We had different people every time, you see, so it wasn't as if we were a pair who always worked together. We were probably allocated to our bomb on the day that we were going to work.
What the sort of front and the back job, which was the least?
Well, I always thought the drum part was required full attention. The plugs at the back, that was not as demanding, if you like the word.
Did you always have to set the machine up from scratch? Or
not necessarily.
No.
Because we might be taking over a machine which was already working. The people who were there probably will have set it up, but the bomb would have been still going through its long, boring, repetitive. It was this, of course, I haven't thought about it for many years, but it made a ticking noise, you know, as these drums moved round and round. So a lot of the time we weren't doing very much because the main job was setting up the bomb, of course. But then when it was going through its menu, there wasn't very much for us to do then. And then one of us stayed with the bomb. One of us was a separate room with telephones. And if the bomb came to a stop, as it was called, then we had to take a reading, and then the reading was sent to Bletchley over the telephone.
And did you know where you were calling?
Well, I knew it was Hut 6. We talked to them, but only really the work. We didn't know them or anything. When it was a stop, which mm-hmm. meant that whatever the men you were setting to discover mm-hmm. had a chance of being discovered. I mean, not every stop resulted in success. And when it was a success, it was a red letter day. It really was. We didn't get many. I don't remember many in my time.
And how would you know if it was a success?
Well, Bletchley would tell us. Whoever sent through the information that they'd put the phone down, and Bletchley obviously would check in a very clever way how whether it was relevant. And if it was, they would ring back, and there was great. I mean, really, it was a fantastic moment for us when they said, yes, that's it. You don't work on that anymore. And then, of course, then it would be when the bomb would be reset for another job.
Right. Did you know the purpose of the
machine? No, we never knew that.
No. So even when you were told it'd been successful, you didn't know what it was
successful? No.
Did you not have an inkling that it was something to do with...
Oh, yes, I think very much so. We knew then vaguely what it was doing. We knew that it was breaking codes and ciphers. Mm. And, of course, we went across for our meals. We have a meal on break in the shift because it was an eight-hour shift. And we would go back to our accommodation. If it was daytime, the cooks and stewards would be there to give us our food. If it was nighttime, they would have left food out for us and we'd get our own. But we never talked about work there because these cooks and stewards didn't know what we were doing. They must have wondered what we were doing, but they didn't know. The food wasn't really good. I remember that.
Heard that. Eastcote had quite a lot of other people there. Did you see much of them? There were Americans,
I think. There were Americans there, but we never saw them. One girl must have done because she had an American boyfriend, but I can't remember seeing the Americans at all.
No.
Oh, I mean, we'd see them about, but we didn't get to know them, really.
No.
I don't know whether we were deliberately kept apart, but I imagine there would have been a certain amount of that. They were probably doing something quite different.
So in terms of military discipline, which I gather was a bit stronger at Eastcote than Bletchley Park...
We had a petty officer, yes, and I remember her name. Erskine Tullock. You remember that one? A very efficient person. I mean, there were some leading men's, and it was fairly relaxed, I thought, in a way. I mean, obviously, there was discipline about it. And I think we had to be in at certain times, that sort of thing, in those days. We were almost self-contained, in a way. You know, we were just given this job to do, and we did it.
Mm. Can you remember any of the names of the other Wrens you were either billeted with or occasionally with?
I can remember a Joan Lynch and an Yvette Burrows. And I made friends with a girl. Her name was, I've forgotten her first name, Hood. Yes, she was one I got to know pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember making close friends there.
When you finished your shifts, did you go out much then?
Oh, yes, we did. We went always up into London, of course, where we were. And I remember when the doodlebugs were coming over, and I went with another girl, I can't remember who she was, and we went into Trafalgar Square, and we stood watching the doodlebugs coming over. And, well, you know about doodlebugs and this distinctive noise they made. It was like a spluttering motorbike, which wasn't working very well. And it was just suddenly stop, and then the thing would just fall down, of course. And we stood there. They were coming over relatively regularly. Yes, there's another one. And an RAF officer came and took us by the arm, dragged us behind one of the lions, and he said, "You so-and-so fools, what do you mean standing there like that? One of those things could just drop. They drop anywhere. They could just as soon drop on you as over there," and gave us an absolute dressing down about that. Shows we were very green, I'm afraid.
What's the sort of things, when you got to London, it was always London, was it, you tend to...
Yes, I think, yes, usually. What we used to do was, in Trafalgar Square, there was a little hut, and we'd go there, getting there as early as we could. The London theatres were still going strong. We could get theatre tickets, which had been kept back in case VIPs wanted to go to a theatre at night. And they were the best seats. They were about 8 rows back in the stalls. But if they hadn't been taken by VIPs, then the tickets were given into this booth and we could have them for nothing. So we saw wonderful plays. Laurence Olivier as a young man, of course, and all the people, Redgraves and all these people. We hadn't got very much money.
No.
But of course we didn't have to spend any. We were always in uniforms. And everything was provided for us. So we didn't really need, well, just as well, we didn't need much money because we hadn't got it. Talking about not having much money, there was a canteen in the crypt of St. Martin in the Field. And we used to go there and we could get a very good meal for a shilling, an old shilling.
Obviously, you'd mentioned earlier you didn't talk to anybody about what you were doing.
No, we didn't.
I assume in the early days you would have signed the Official Secrets Act.
Oh, yes. Yes, we did.
And did they impress on you that you were not to talk
to them? Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
I suppose that helps then, not knowing very much
what you were doing. We just accepted. That was the job. Yeah. And,
did family or friends try and find out what you were doing?
No.
No.
I can't remember that I was ever asked what I did.
No.
My father was in the army. My mother had a new baby. She'd had to take in evacuees because evacuees came from Liverpool and Birkenhead.
So when did you begin to understand or hear about what you'd been doing and the connection with Bletchley Park?
Well, not. I didn't know the big picture, of course, as I suppose none of us did. Until, it must have been in the 70s, was it? Yeah.
Mm.
Well, that's the first time I had a picture of what was going on. I mean, we knew that the people at Bletchley were the brilliant people. This wonderful work which they did and how clever they must have been. But of course, we never saw them. And we knew the huts did different things.
Even when it came out, it's taken a while before you decided to...
I still didn't talk about it.
No.
In fact, I don't think anybody here... Well, my best friend, I think she only knew when I was going to the veterans meeting. I have never talked about it, you see. Maybe because it shows how old I am.
So does it feel odd talking about it now or not?
The only people who I talk about to... my family, particularly my grandsons, are so interested in it. And going back to the first day when I went with my daughter, and when she said to them that I'd been involved, you see, they were, quite thrilled. And one of them said to me, we had one of you in here last week, but she was in a wheelchair. And he said, come to think of it, I haven't seen one of you who wasn't in a wheelchair. It was quite funny.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy, write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.